Five, four, three, two, one. Are we live there? Can you give me a number one if we're live in the chat and you can hear me? Am I coming through loud and clear? It says so on the I see we've got all the regulars back once again in the chat there. Here we go, lovely. All the regular classic movie team. I'm starting to see many of them at all. I've even had a coffee off Hunky Haggis, which I'll get to later on and at the towards the end of the stream. We are here to engage in a bit of British nostalgia, a bit of British dare and do, and just a very British saga of the SAS, terrorists and lefties, and the need to infiltrate them and put them down. And it's nice. It's a good film, and it's not Hollywood. And we just don't do stuff like this anymore. It's also got like the absolute mad lad Chad Lewis Collins, who actually like genuinely was a proper soldier in the British Army. People might know him but for being in the professionals as well. I mean, this is all getting a little bit obscure for some of the younger ones, but we'll come on to all of that. I am joined, as always, by Endeavour. Oh, welcome to Classic Movies, everybody. And I am joined by Endeavour, as always. How are you doing, Endeavour?
I'm doing great. I enjoyed the film. It was the first time I got to see this movie, and there's quite a bit to say about it, so I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah, I hadn't seen this forever. Like, I hadn't seen this since I was a little kid, when it seemed to be all over the place. But we'll come on to all of that. I mean, this is the problem when you sometimes I think we do kind of really mainstream ones, which you know everybody's going to have seen, which is just kind of easy. But this has become a bit obscure, I think, and it's a kind of cultural artifact. I mean, I don't know if anybody in America would have seen this at all. I don't know if this had reach in America. Well, obviously, because I'm old, I remember it being on the telly growing up, like when I was a little kid in the 80s and stuff. And so, it's. I hope that people just stick with it anyway because it's a good laugh, even if you haven't seen it. Because I do get that some of the ones we've done are a little bit obscure, but that's the whole point. It's about unearthing all of these forgotten classics, as well as hitting on some of the more mainstream stuff. So the Who Dares Wins then is, I mean, just look at the banner, look at the aesthetics they've got. The aesthetics of the SAS, like just from the start, just the way they look is just class. It's with the gas mask and all the rest of it. And they really go to town on this as well. So I think just to break down the plot a little bit, I think it's, I mean, it's not the most complicated film, any, but it's got a lot of nice, interesting layers to it, especially from the perspective of today. Everybody's more politically engaged. These are the bits that I just completely forgot about when I glanced over and didn't care about when I was watching it when I was a kid. And I think it's fair to say that you can split the film in two halves. The first half features we go up and we're on the Brecon Beacons with the SAS, and they're on a training mission. And that hard lad on the right, he beats up. There's some officers arriving, some soldiers have arrived. One of them sounds, well, one of them's American, the other one sounds a bit German. So if you think of the time that this was happening, it would be like the Cold War was there. He was probably from West Germany, and they were coming over
He
to
was
get
from
some tips.
GSG9. It was
What's
GSG9.
that?
It's the German version of the SAS.
Right, so they've come over to pick up some tips from the SAS. And we'll come back a little bit about the SAS's sort of place in British culture and whatnot as we get on. Let's get the plot and the basics out of the way. Let's set up the scaffolding and then we can get on to a better conversation later. And he ties them up and gives them a good kick in. He kind of tortures them on top of the Brecon Beacons and then he's discharged. And it always seems kind of weird because you think, well, it's confusing because you don't know that this is a kind of setup. So he gets dishonorably discharged. He resigns, I think it is. But at any rate, it's a bit of a kabuki theater, so that he can get out of the service without it drawing any attention. And then we find quite quickly he's got a lovely wife, he's got a child, but he's on a mission to infiltrate a far left organization which is up to no good. And at the time of the 70s, the early 80s, a huge thing on the left in Britain and across Europe, it didn't seem to be as big in America, but it was called the CND, which was the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. You've got to remember, this is at the height of the Cold War, and they are basically demanding that the West gets rid of its nukes. And within this larger movement, there's a splinter cell, if you like, of radicals who are planning to do some kind of operation, but it isn't really revealed what it is. So our lad, who's called Peter Skellen, is now kind of, well, he's undercover. And he approaches the woman on the left there, who, like, isn't it amazing, though, like, how, like, that could be a leftist today. Like, they have, like, if you were to look at the political spectrum and you were to go on the street and you were to show them, like, that slide on the screen there, and you said, which is the left wing and which is the right wing? Like, they would absolutely just, that would be obvious to everybody, wouldn't it? Isn't that weird?
I'm still seeing the slide of the two guys in SWAT gear.
Are you?
Yeah.
Weird.
But the point about, like, what the woman looks like. Yeah, I mean, today would she even look like a leftist? You can see in the 1980s that you can see that she would have had this lefty vibe, but then these days, I mean, she would have been too attractive to be a leftist these days. She'd have to be a lot fatter, have dyed hair and piercings everywhere. But you can kind of see it from the 1980s aesthetic, like kind of the more old left Marxist banners and everything, maybe the things like punk rock, stuff like that. You get that kind of vibe from the 1980s left, but I mean the new left, they're not that I think the 80s left was cool, but the ones these days, they're not nearly as attractive. Like you think of like the 1970s or the 1960s with these hippie chicks at Woodstock or something like that. Someone like Joni Mitchell, I mean their politics might be crap, but she's still a pretty girl, and you could see if you were like some young guy, you might think, oh well, you know, I don't really believe in this whole hippie movement, this whole like anti, like Vietnam or nuclear disarmament or stuff, but oh well, we have this nice blonde girl here, and maybe I'll go along to the protests with them. But yeah, these days you definitely wouldn't get that with the left. So yeah, now I can see the picture. Yeah, so you have the SAS guy on the right, and then you have the woman's on the left, and this is that kind of libtard woman in the film.
Yeah, I will say I think overall, like the kind of the leftist, they call it the People's Lobby, and overall it just sort of oozes like feminine energy. There's another woman who we'll come on to later, who's there's like kind of two people in charge. There's the one that's on the left there, and then there's the one, another one that we'll come on to later, who's a total psycho. And then they've got like these simps around them. So all of the lefty men in the terror cell are all these kind of weak simps. And like Peter Skellen's just, so how he actually approaches the woman's a bit of a laugh as well, because she's giving this kind of postmodern theatrical performance, which is interesting, to be fair, in its own right, where she's got the Statue of Liberty, and it's like on stage, and then it's as if the Statue of Liberty is this kind of specter of death, and Western capitalism is destroying the world, and with nuclear bombs is the focus of this story, being like the sort of the final outcome of capitalism is the nuclear bomb, which is going to annihilate humanity. And so they've got all of this symbolism about like capitalism being a death cult. And then like she's got all of her like these little simps around her as well. It just amazes me that so this is from like 1982, and they've just, it's like the left just hasn't changed at all. And Skellen rocks up or like sort of undercover, and he basically just, she basically just within 15 minutes he's got her like sort of ready for bed. Like she's just gonna take her knickers off. She's just overwhelmed by his charred energy. And really you could say the core message of Who Dares Wins is like never ever allow your radical political movement to be run by women. Because what's gonna happen is some chad's gonna rock up to her in the bar. Get her knickers down, get her a few drinks, and then that's it. So within like a day or two, he's moved in, he's shacked up with her, and all of the simps are raging and seething. they're all seething because they're saying like, hang on a minute, like, who is he? Oh, he's ex-SAS, but that's all in the past and I trust him. And it's just like, well, maybe you're wrong. Like, is this not a risk? But you can't talk to her anyway because she's a woman, and she does it anyway. It's just a total disaster zone as far as their movement is concerned. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I mentioned that some of the lefty women back then might have actually been kind of attractive in the hippie days, but the lefty men, though, they're just pathetic. Like even back then, you can see that they're all just total beta males. They kind of, like you had said, they kind of emit this feminine energy, and they're total simps. And well, and they're being bossed around by a woman. And when this big masculine man in Captain Skellen shows up, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I'm SAS." I mean, these guys definitely know that he's not one of them, because you know they actually are leftist dudes, and they know that an SAS Chad guy like pulsating with testosterone is not going to be some libtard who's against who's campaigning for nuclear disarmament. You also do see like the scenes where she's just like bossing them around, or then there's the other there's that other woman, the blonde woman, and then you know all these there's that really pathetic scene where they're doing that target practice with the Uzis, and there are all these men like really these kind of beta males being bossed around by this woman, and like, well, that's definitely leftist men for you. She might be this, like, you know, the main woman, what's her name? Her name was Frankie, I think it was the one on the screen right now. She might have been this kind of like feminist far left, or ultra radical, but then once Chad shows up, Chad from the SAS, well, I mean, all that kind of just goes out the window.
All the feminism just went straight out the window. And it's made clear as well that she's like, because she's got a nice flat, she seems to be well taken care of, and Skellen is like, well, how did you get all of this stuff? And she says, yeah, I've got a rich dad, and he provides me, he bankrolls my lifestyle to be like this, because she's American as well, I should have pointed out. And it's like, yeah, I've got this rich daddy back in America, and he's bankrolling my subversive far left activities in Britain, in England. And it's just, again, it's just like all of the cliches and the archetypes from a film from like 1982, where she's just this. Well, I mean, we'll come on to that later because she gets wrecked. You didn't like it, but I did. That's farther down the road. So another thing that happens, of course, is that there's another woman. I haven't got the actual slide, but she's called Ingrid Pitt, and she's been around quite a bit as well. And she's she's like the psycho of the radical left, and she kills Skellen's contact because she actually does think there's something fishy about all of this. And so he's kind of severed from connecting back to base, if you like. It creates a bit of a problem. And then they move on. So this kind of takes us up where the plan is about to go in motion. And that takes us on into the second part of the film, really. There's a few other things happen, though. Like, they go to a church, and you've got this kind of shit-lib priest, and he's preaching about nuclear disarmament as well, and sort of, we love the world, God's children, and all the rest of it. And then there's a fight that breaks out. Now, the Woodlander told me that fight, it was on Twitter, but it was something to do with the skinheads. Obviously, they weren't real skinheads or anything like that. It was all like acting. But basically, the gist of it is that you've got these radical groups, and they're all infiltrated by British intelligence, and they're being played off against each other. And on top of that, there's this kind of shady sort of string puller who only pops up three times in the films. He's called Malik in the show notes on Wikipedia. And you can see at the beginning of the film, he's the first one that comes on, and he makes a big bank deposit, and he's actually bankrolling her organization. And then he pops up again at the bit where there's a scuffle and a punch up in the church between the far left and the far right. He's very happy about that outcome. And then he pops up at the very end of the movie again. And so it's to give this idea that you've got all of these different layers of manipulation and fun and games, and that the British intelligence services, I mean, or like the last line of defense. If the actual alternative name, this is called Who Dares Wins, but it's also called The Final Option. I think maybe that was the name that went out in America or something, and I think it was a book as well. But basically, that's what they are. They're the final option. When all of the rest, everything, all of the soft power has failed, then the SES are going to get sent in as the hardest of hard power. Basically, they're just going to kill. And we see that happen. So when we go to the middle section of the film, you see that Skellen's been rumbled, and his wife and kids are taken hostage as they're about to go into the final sort of zone of the film. So the big master plan here, I know I've been talking for a while, I'll wrap it up just at this little point here. The big master plan is American Secretary of State is coming over. They're going to have a big shindig with the British government at a country house. And Frankie and her sort of radical left commies are going to hold them all hostage and demand that it's called somewhere in Scotland, but they demand that that is nuked and blown up, to make the point. And so that they were at Holy Lock, and they're going to say, well, we're going to nuke that, and you're going to have full nuclear disarmament in the West. And it's a ridiculous claim. It's a ridiculous demand. And we'll get onto that later as well. But that's the point that the SAS has sent in. And the bit that's on the screen now is where they basically, I'll put this one on, if you give me a second. This is where the a great scene where the psycho German, I think she is about to shoot Skellen's wife and baby, and the SAS conduct this operation on the next door of his house, where they're next door, and they put these cameras through the wall, and then they sort of very carefully, they turn the music up really loud to disguise the sound, and then they're slowly boring their way through the wall, and just as Skellen's wife and child are going to be executed, they just burst through the wall and shoot both of the commies dead. I mean, they shoot her about five times in the face. It's really brutal. Would you say that's a fair assessment of it so far?
It's a good synopsis of the plot, but it is important to add what kind of reveals at the end with the character of Malik, I believe it was, and then the British Lord.
One of the side things that I really like about this, and I do, is that you get this sort of in these kinds of films. We did this. I watched The Longest Day a while back as well. You also see it in stuff like Lawrence of Arabia, where you get to see like the British sort of deep state, if you like, grappling with a problem. It's one of those things that I always love. I always love with these men with really high positions in society, a lot of power, confronted with a major problem. You see here, we've got Edward Woodward from The Wicker Man. Also, Ingrid Pitt, I saw in the chat, she was also in The Wicker Man. Tony Doyle is also in this as a SAS sergeant or captain or whatever. And so here you get the brains of the British establishment, if you like, the boots on the ground, the power and the institutions getting to grips with the problem. And I always like it because they've always got this kind of informal manner where on the one hand, they're really curt and really cold. And they've still got, at this stage in like 1982, they've still got a lot of the sort of mannerisms and elitist sort of pretensions of the British Empire. Like it's still there at this point. I don't think it'll be there now. I dread to think who is in their positions now in the British government, who is in charge of the Met Police or who is in charge of surveillance and intelligence and all of this kind of... I mean, God only knows who's in charge of all of that now. It would just be a nightmare. Ultimately, it's Shemama Mahmood at the Home Office. That's who would be their boss today.
The problem we have today is that it's all just these managerial types in these positions, which they are totally unfit for. So in Canada, for example, I think the leading general in the Canadian Army is some like dried up old grandma who looks like some like lesbian from the 1970s or something like that, who was out there crying about the racism of the Canadian military on stage. And it's like, how could you possibly actually take this person seriously as somebody with that kind of authority? Like something like the military, the Secret Service, the police. It's a very masculine institution, and the idea that it would be some kind of like HR cat lady in charge of it. I mean, it's no wonder that they're so incompetent today. It's no wonder that the British police were, when you think of something like the grooming scandals or any number of things, that they're more concerned about mean posts on social media than in stopping actual crime. But you know, I think that's kind of the end result of this kind of managerial leftist ideology just taking over these institutions slowly over the course of the last couple of decades. But in the 1980s, all this stuff still was. I know that I'm not a big fan of Ronald Reagan or Margaret Thatcher. From today's perspective, we kind of see that they really weren't our guys, or I guess in Margaret Thatcher's case, our girl. We can really see that they wouldn't have been aligned with us. But something like the FBI or something like or the CIA, you see these in these movies in the 80s, they're always these badass guys. And it always seems like that's on behalf of it's on behalf of the state, but there's still kind of an understanding that the state has the back of the everyman, that it's actually working in favor of the people rather than in against them. Whereas when you look at something today, so when you look at something like the FBI or the CIA under the Biden administration, I mean, it was filled with all these diversity hires, and even the Trump one, I mean, it's with Kash Patel, some dorky cross-eyed Indian guy is now leading the FBI. And even though he might spout off some right-wing platitudes, he certainly doesn't have anything on the guys that like you see in the frame here. I think that's something like James Bond is maybe an earlier incarnation. I think that the movie Who Dares Win is kind of like a more realistic version of James Bond. So in Bond, he's a 00 agent, licensed to kill. He goes off and fights Spectre, this international organization of terrorists and billionaires who want to blow up the world and things like that. And in James Bond, he has these gadgets. He gets into fights with these super villains on a plane that's crashing or something like that, and I mean it's all really fun. We did a stream on James Bond, and I love the James Bond franchise, but it's very bombastic, and it's kind of like over the top and ridiculous, but you just love the action. With this one, you see that the guy that you see, Captain Selin, I mean, he has a wife and a kid. The people that they're infiltrating aren't these don't have this base in a volcano. It's just kind of this dirty group of leftists with some beta males and some wing feminist women. Of course, they're being bankrolled, but the actual operation itself is not that impressive. And I mean, it is a hostage situation. So the SAS, they are the guys that actually come in and take out the villains, but it's not in like quite as a dramatic fashion as you'd see in something like James Bond. This one's a bit more, I mean, obviously it's an action movie, but it's a bit more grounded in a bit more realism, which is cool, because something like James Bond, I think you had made the point before that he was a figure that obviously was fictional and very exaggerated, but the idea that there exists this deep state that's out there to save the world and you know, so that you can go to bed at safely at night. The SAS is it is kind of like that, or at least it would have been in a more healthy era. And you like the idea that there are these hyper masculine, extremely competent guys that can break into a building, take out a bunch of terrorists, and then everyone can go home and sleep safely at night. If the only problem, I think you mentioned this earlier, but it's just that we would wish that this would work in our favor today, even though the state really doesn't. But it is cool to see it.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that a lot of people say that Lewis Collins, who's Skellen, the main character in this, is the greatest James Bond that we never had. And yeah, you can see it that he is. And in this case, this would be like Q and M and all the rest of it on the screen here now. So it is more realistic. And there's an interesting line in the film where Skellen and Frankie are having an argument. And she turns to him and says, well, so you just think that public opinion doesn't matter. And then Skellen, as the kind of the Chad elite theorist, if you like, he basically says, no, I know for a fact it doesn't. And when you see like this lot here, you can see why, because we're living in it. Because these are, as the title suggests, the final option. So these are the men who are ultimately going to decide what happens and where things go in terms of kind of practical politics or what radical movements are allowed and disallowed. But see, otherwise, like somebody somewhere had to make the call. CND was kind of mainstream. It was lefty and all of that. But they did have protests all over the place. But then when you've got this splinter group from it, the People's Lobby, somebody somewhere has decided that group in particular has to be infiltrated and watched. Now, they're doing this to us as well. Like they're doing this to every Twitter chat and every Telegram chat, and they'll be doing it with Restore, and they'll probably be doing it with Reform. But then again, you know, not to get bogged down in current day politics, people would say that, well, Reform's just their outfit. Like this is ultimately who Nigel Farage is having brandy and cakes with on a weekend behind closed doors to keep these radical movements and these radical seeds in a safe place. But of course, to get back to the story, the terror cell in this is actually going to end up killing people, and it is actually end up going to do a hell of a lot of damage. So there's a bus full of American soldiers on their way to the mansion, and then they hijack the bus. They brutally kill. This is when it's getting dark, because there definitely is a first half and a second half to the film. The first half is mainly about cloak and dagger, and it's about politics and about the idealistic sort of outlook of the left, I would say, actually. And here you get the kind of pragmatic power of the center. That's what we're looking at on screen right now. They're not particularly ideological. But the distinction is that, and this is what we lack today, this is why everything's so out of whack, is that you can imagine here people could dispute it, because let's be honest, right? The British deep state has done a lot of nasty dark shit around the world, like for a long, long time. I mean, they were up to all kinds of shenanigans in Northern Ireland as this film came out. I mean, there's a bit of a tangent here. I'm going on a tangent of a tangent. I think the major reason that we got this film is because in 1979, the Iranian embassy siege happened. And for the first time, because there was cameras everywhere, the SAS were actually on camera. They were caught. So everybody had heard that there was the Special Air Service was out there. And there'd been, I think there'd been like a few books written, and it had been around since, I think, World War II, where you would have this kind of special elite who just killed. And when in 1979 you had the Iranian hostage crisis, it was the first time that everybody saw them. And they immediately took on this sort of quasi-mystical characteristics, where it was like there was something in the sort of the post-war, post-empire era. There was this idea that, well, we're not going to be as powerful as we once were, but we can be stripped down and be more surgical and be more precise and more lethal and deadly in that way. I mean, the Falklands War, which happened in the year that this was released, leaned into that. And there's stuff like this that the other one, North Sea Hijack, is another one which I watched recently, which leans into this as well, where you've got the British Army and the British state. It doesn't have all these huge fleets of aircraft carriers and giant continental armies. I mean, never really did have that. But we can be professional and surgical, and we can really punch above our weight. And I think it actually worked. I think it actually worked as a kind of cultural mythos, and I think it did a good job. And you could, even then, despite a lot of the dark, shady shit that the British deep state's done, you could kind of buy into the fact that at the end of the day, they were these paternalistic, sort of highly competent, highly capable white men who were the last line of defense. And like we've talked about before with James Bond, part of the disillusionment of where we are now is that you know it's just not the case. You know that, and I wrote an article about, because I'm a fan of John Le Carre. I watched Smiley's People and the other Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I got the DVD box set. I picked them up for a couple of pounds and I watched them with Alec Guinness. And I read the books years ago as well. And you see there, like, and I made the point that, like, in an article that I wrote, that how do they process what's happening in the country? How do the versions of them today justify trying to get somebody's bank account closed down because they had the wrong opinions, or, you know, you launch a political party because you're scared about the demographic situation, and they make a few phone calls, you can never get the party registered. And I've never understood how they managed to square that circle, because at the end of the day, they are just, well, at least they are. I don't actually know what they'd look like today. This is the problem. If you've got like diversity hires in those positions today, you just can't actually make that call because they don't have that connection to the nation.
I think that that's part of it, because you see that a lot of these police forces, like you, I'm sure you'll see this with the London Met Police. You'll see this with the police in Canada. You'll see this with you saw this in the Biden era with the for the FBI and things like this in the United States. They chalked them full of these so-called diversity hires. It's the bio-Leninism that a competent, self-respecting white man in a position of power like this. I mean, he's still beholden to power ultimately, but he's more likely to have second thoughts about any number of things. Like, let's say, for example, turning a blind eye to something like the grooming scandal. Now, we do know that, unfortunately, a lot of the police forces did do that in parts of England. But when it's somebody who their entire status is based on this kind of on this bio-Leninism, it's based on this kind of the elevation that they're given by leftist ideology, then this person is going to be a fearsome defender of the system. So the theory of bio-Leninism is that if you put people who are incompetent, who wouldn't be able to attain a position of power organically, if you put that person in a position of power, if you artificially elevate their status, then that person is just going to be a fearsome defender of this, of the system, of that kind of power structure, because their artificially elevated status is entirely reliant on it. Think of, like, there's this phrase that came out, and I mean, maybe it might be going out of, I know this stuff's a bit on the decline, but there was a phrase that came out. It was the tranisaur. It's not the commissar, it's the tranisar. And what this is like some transgender person that you get in some institution. And then this person, it just fearsomely enforces all the woke LGBT diversity shit that we got so used to over the last couple of years. Because this person's, you know, they, without this ideology being hegemonic, and without the system which props them up, this person would be a loser. They'd be an outcast. And that's one of the reasons that they have a lot of these policies to promote people who, well, are going to be loyal to the current zeitgeist. Now, I don't want to go too far with that, because I still think that what you do see is that there are, I don't want to say that every single person in a position of authority is like that, because they aren't. So, for example, when you look at something like the operation that the U.S. did in Venezuela, regardless of what people think about it, I mean, the actual political implications are not important. They had the picture of the men that pulled it off, and they're all white men. They all look like they're like highly trained soldiers. They look like the SAS guys in this film. And I'm sure that, you know, if there were, even in a multi-culti city like London or something like that, or New York or wherever it is, I guarantee you, if there were some kind of hostage situation, the guys that get called in to actually deal with the threat, they're probably going to look a lot more like the men in the movie Who Dares Wins than they would some kind of diversity PR ad campaign that one of these police forces might release. So I think what they do is they get these people into positions of power. But at the end of the day, the problem with bio-Leninism is that the benefit for the system is that it staffs the institutions with people who are extremely loyal to them, but those people are incompetent. So it staffs them with incompetent people, and you can't actually get the job done. Now, I mean, they are people who are primarily motivated by malice, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a degree of incompetence that comes along with them, being artificially given this increase in their in power and influence. So I think today you would probably just have a lot of guys who are just rule followers who just go along with the orders that they get from above. So, I mean, an example, yeah, out of Canada, just to finish off, like an example out of Canada, when the truckers protest happened in 2022, the RCMP, they basically followed rule orders, and they went out there and ran over protesters with their horses and everything like that. So eventually, you know, what you tend to see is that these types of people, they typically just follow the orders from above.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good time to have a look at, I'll just conveniently slip in Hunky Haggis's coffee here, because it relates to this. And he says, the Brits have always punched above their weight militarily. What factors do you think make the Anglo-Celt soldier the best in the world? For me, it's humility, excellent training, the pursuit of excellence, and very underestimated, the sense of humor. And why is it Anglo-Celtic countries like the US and Australia can't match us despite being the same people? I'm not sure. There's a bit of a thing that goes around, right? But apparently the SAS did like a training exercise, and the American equivalent came over. And apparently this has been happening for years, and they'll do like some training thing on the Brecon Beacons or the Yorkshire Dales or the Highlands of Scotland or something. And the SAS always run circles around the Americans. I have never looked that up. I don't know if it's true. And I think it is true, to be honest. I remember it being in like the Daily Mail. But regardless of that, I wouldn't actually say that the American soldiers, the Anglo-Celtic American soldiers, are any better or worse. Same as Australians, I think, because ethnically they're all the same. And what I mean is, there's a funny thing about this that somebody pointed out a while ago, that if you look, for example, the army recruitment ads are always targeting Northern England and Scotland. Or it could, I mean, if it could be like this targeted ad thing, but for example, I get bombarded with ads on YouTube, and it is a lad who sounds like he's from Sunderland or Middlesbrough, sort of south of me. There's a woman, there's a girl in her 20s who's got an accent like me. And then there'll be like a Scottish one. You'll get like a Scouse one or a sort of Manchester twang. And then sometimes they'll also have like a black fella who sounds like he's from London somewhere. So this is their talent pool that they're trying to recruit for the front line of the army, if you like. And the funny thing is, like somebody pointed out to me a while ago, it might have been Closeton or one of the Americans. I think it might have been, oh, it doesn't matter. But what they were pointing out is that if you have a look at the actual where the Americans recruit from, it's places like Appalachia. It's where the kind of Scots, Irish, and English went. So they're still drawing from that same ethnic stock to be their warriors, even after all this time. They're not really going into sort of, I know there's like jokes about how like the American army will be like all these Mexicans and whatnot, but they seem to have all their bases in like North Carolina. And there's a certain demographic that they kind of look at as their prime fighting stock. And it's pretty much the same as what the British government seems to go after. So it's all well and good having a bit of a knockabout. So the SAS like owned the Rangers or whoever, but by and large it seems to be the same people, like the same ethnic stock doing the killing, regardless of where they're from.
So one thing I wanted to get onto, because I thought about this theme a lot in the movie, because they had this scene. So yeah, it's that scene on the screen right now. Now what happens is when the terrorists from the People's Lobby capture, it's the Secretary of State, the ambassador, some general, so both high-ranking British and American officials. There's a scene where the Secretary of the State of the United States. He basically says to her, the woman, like, so you're going to kill people in the name of peace. You're going to engage in terrorism because you want to create a nuclear explosion in order to stop a nuclear explosion. I mean, one of the criticisms I do have of the film is that I feel like that scene was a bit on the nose. I think that they kind of just had one line of dialogue of him saying, like, oh, so you're terrorists in pursuit of peace. I thought that it was a bit on the nose that they had to like explain it to us. But I think that what one theme that you see in this film, which I think is very important for understanding the far left mindset. So the People's Lobby, they're this far left Marxist organization who have attached themselves onto the movement for nuclear disarmament. The cause is that they are against nuclear wars. They don't want Western countries to have nuclear weapons because they think it creates this threat of nuclear war. And that's kind of a more of a normie movement, but then the People's Lobby is a more radical militant wing of that. And there's a contradiction, which they point out in the movie, that a group of violent militants purporting to be warriors of peace, it doesn't make any sense. However, I think one thing you see in the movie, and then you can see this play out in real life as well, is that you should understand that the motive of people like the People's Lobby, as they're portrayed in movie, and various far left groups as we see them today, things like Antifa, things like Extinction Rebellion or BLM or whatever it is, they always have some like hyper moralistic vitriol, which is what their cause is predicated on. So it's some kind of moral indictment against Western society. It might be it's racism or capitalism or environmental damage, or in the case of the movie, nuclear weapons. But what you'll always find is that really just serves as a justification for nihilistic destruction. So the narrative is that, I mean, the one we were under today is that it's about race, but in the one in this one, it was about war and nuclear weapons. The narrative is always something along the lines of, well, the West is inherently evil, it's morally illegitimate, and it must be torn down. But then when you start to poke holes in that, saying like, well, is this actually going to end any wars? Well, you know, they pointed out in the movie that, first of all, they're violent terrorists in pursuit of peace, but also that their plan isn't actually going to end wars. It's just going to disarm the Western countries and make them subject to everyone who hasn't done the same. We'll get onto that later. But what you find out is that they don't actually care about the supposed moral crusade. The destructive nihilism, that is the goal of people like this. So there was this great meme about it was related to the climate change one, but you see this with the race and the LGBT stuff, with the hippie kind of anti-war stuff in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. There was this meme about the climate change one. What they said was, well, we need to have this totalitarian managerial grid controlling every aspect of people's lives and terrorizing people so that we can stop climate change. And then someone says, well, couldn't we just do this? And it's like, no, you don't understand. I don't actually want to stop climate change. I just want this totalitarian grid which controls people's lives and ruins society. And you, when you scratch the surface enough with them, you always end up there with the left and with the far left. Think of something like BLM. So like back in 2020, caused massive amounts of property damage, violence, people killed, people injured. There was, in the aftermath, there was a huge crime spike. Billions of dollars were pumped into these so-called equity programs. All these companies had these affirmative action programs, which got white people denied opportunities in business and in universities. Priceless cultural icons were destroyed. And after all of that, were the lives of Black people actually improved? Well, clearly not, but it caused destruction. And the thing is that at the end of the day, the nihilistic destruction is the goal of people like this. I mean, because their goal of, in the case of the whole race one, the goal of equity, I don't think that's actually even possible. But that's not even the goal to begin with. The goal is the nihilistic destruction. And you see that with things like Extinction Rebellion. Why do they deface a priceless work of art in protest of environmentalism and of carbon emissions and climate change? How is that actually going to solve anything? Well, what you find with these types is they don't actually want to stop climate change. They actually just wanted to deface a priceless piece of art, because at the root of it, at the root of the far left, is nihilism.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I quite like the scene. So it is important, because I think it's a real poke in the eye to leftists in general. So Richard Widmark is the American Secretary of State. They've taken over the mansion. They've evacuated they evacuate the servants first, of course, because they're all on board with the little people, aren't they? But this is about to be exposed. And then they get rid of their wives as well. There's a scene where there's an old actor, is it something Cobb? He tries to snatch a gun, he gets shot. So by this time, they have actually killed, I think, four people in total. Oh, no, five. I think they shoot another guard inside. So they've actually shot five people dead. So, you know, they've passed way beyond where we can think of them as peaceful in any way. And a confrontation comes between Frankie and Richard Widmark as sort of representation of the American government higher up as well. And he says, can I have a word with you for a moment? And then she's got all this kind of sass and attitude, and it's kind of theatrical and over the top. And he's like, yeah, okay. But again, she does a good job of like doing a kind of leftist nut job. And he's like, so the plan is, let's just get the plan here, because it's ridiculous. The plan is they will drop a nuke on Holy Lock in Scotland at the naval base. And on the outside of this, Edward Woodward has got on the phone to her saying, you're going to have to give me some time because I have to evacuate all of the people. And then I have to get in touch with the Prime Minister to release the nuclear weapon, or at least give the go ahead. But then in a little kind of a little kind of interesting touch. He says the Prime Minister will have to get in touch with the American government to see if we can have the keys to our own nukes. Now, straight away, let's just straight away, this is like Cook Britannia. Why aren't we in charge of our own nukes? Apparently, it was Thatcher that gave that away. But whatever, that's the situation that we're in. We don't get to use nukes. We've got to defer to the American president. But even then, the American president is not going to allow what would be, from the American perspective, the British government to nuke its own territory. There's no scenario where they nuke anything to save these diplomats and bureaucrats and politicians. There just isn't. That is never going to be an outcome. They will let them all get shot before they do any, before they touch or go anywhere near a nuclear bomb. They will just kind of write them off and have them replaced within a couple of weeks. It's as simple as that. So the plan's bullshit from the start. But then what's interesting, I like the exchange, because Richard Widmark outlines that, says this is your plan. It's not going to happen. They're just going to allow us to be shot. But even then, even if that was the case, you are doing this on what authority? And then she says, I'm doing it on the authority of like global humanity, or the humanity, the people of the world, the poor people, and all of this kind of thing. And he's saying, but you're not, because you're about to drop a nuclear bomb on them. What is it? Is that a price worth paying? Like, how do you wire that up in your head? It is a little bit on the nose. It is a kind of well-scripted kind of own of like left-wing thinking, which I'm, even if it is on the nose, I'm definitely gonna give it a pass. And so she says, well, sometimes we have to make difficult decisions. But then his retort is, but this is exactly what we are trying to do. Because she's saying, I want world peace. And he's saying, but that's exactly what we're trying to do as well. And it gets into this problem of, how exactly do you, like she seems to think in her kind of shit-lib lefty commie mind, and she says it explicitly, actually, that these rich fat cats at the top are kind of like using nuclear weapons to persecute people or oppress them or something like that. It's just nonsensical. Whereas what Richard Widmark's saying is that in the year, say, 1982, we live in a world where everybody has nuclear weapons. So the issue here is, how do we deal with that as a reality? And so her solution to this is to force the West to nuke itself, because the whole world would see how horrible that was. I mean, as if they didn't see that already just a few decades earlier in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And so, like, we know. So that's bullshit. And then everybody will unilaterally disarm because they'll see how bad nukes are. And he's pointing out, like, they won't. They won't. And she's saying, well, they will, and it's going to start in this room. So it's all just this wish-casting thinking. It's all just this pie-in-the-sky nonsense. It's madness. And then he gets the little point in. So it, I suppose the world, the disarmament of all nukes in the world, but the Western liberal democracies first. That's how you're going, isn't it? And by that time, she just gets really frustrated and kind of storms off. That's the bit when she walks off the television studio and calls him a racist. Because it's like what you are saying as well. It's like, on the one hand, she's going to have these sort of humanitarian ideals, as if there's one human family that can bind together. But we in the West have to go first. And it's just the same as like, oh, well, racism and tribalism, we're against it, it's evil, but white people have to go first. And we're just kind of close our eyes and not really think that the other people might have agency, that the other tribes and nations around the world have their own agendas and their own way of looking at the world. We'll just assume that they are all default lefty shitlibs, just like me, and that once we get rid of the ruling class in the West, or the Richard Widmarks of the world, then everything will be grand. And so you get this rare thing in this film where it's a kind of defense of the ruling elites of the West and how, like, the left are nutballs. Because usually it would the people in Hollywood or the people doing TV shows, they would be the ones writing this. And there's not going to be this sort of scenario where she comes out of this with anything at all. Do you see what I mean? Do you want to go?
Yeah, there? I actually had something written about this too. So it's with the ulterior motives of moralism, especially a moralism of some kind of universal variety. So the People's Lobby purports to be this moralistic utopian crusade in the name of universal peace. However, their aims are really only going to detriment one side of the equation to the political expediency of the other side. So this is the Cold War we're talking about. What they don't what the People's Lobby doesn't address is they want the Western powers, so that mainly being being the United States, because at this point it was the U.S. in their sphere of influence. But we can just look at it from like the East versus West. But it was United States and USSR. They want the America and the American led Western bloc to disarm. Well, that's not going to bring about world peace. All that's going to do is that it would leave the West with no deterrent against military action from the USSR-led Eastern Bloc. They claim to want total nuclear disarmament, but it's only really directed towards one side. And the real-world effect of this agenda, if successful, it wouldn't be universal peace. It would just be whoever actually went ahead and went along with this kind of lefty peacenik agenda. They're just going to be subject of whoever doesn't. And you see this really commonly in politics. It's this appeal to universalist morality. And it very often acts as this cloak for particularist interest groups. Now, I don't know if in the movie, I don't think that it says that they were like agents of the Eastern Bloc. They do get into like who was about this group being funded. But it's not like implied that necessarily Moscow was funding them. But You could see why, and we do know that this did happen, that the East would fund groups like this, like campaigns for nuclear disarmament in the West at the time. And then it was vice versa as well. So, the West would fund kind of more liberal movements in Eastern Europe. They'd try to get pop culture from the West in. And it's always under this guise as kind of this universalism. And what it ends up doing is actually just working in favor of whoever doesn't adopt it. You can think about the universalist egalitarian ideology of the present day. Not that we need to go into it too much here, but as I'm sure everybody listening to this stream knows, this ideology was created by the most ethnocentric group in the world. And their real motive was to break white ethnocentrism and maintain their own, to eliminate a rival, not to bring about this universal humanity. You think of all these, like, these anti-racist movements. Well, then, I mean, whites have been made the least ethnocentric group over the past 70 years in the world. So why is it that all the anti-racism stuff is directed at us? It's like, well, we have to get rid of our own source of power. If we had it, I mean, it would be a source of power, but we can't possibly think of that. But all these other groups, they're going to continue to do that, and they continue to get what they want. So all these ethnic lobbies, which now exist in the West, there's the one big one, and then there are now plenty of other ones with all the other minority groups now. None of them are getting rid of their own ethnocentrism. It's just us that are expected to, and the end result is not us all holding hands and singing Kumbaya together. The end result is that we would just be subject to them. Think about something like kind of delving into present day politics a bit here, but I think who he was blackmailing, publicly, all these people are dyed-in-the-wool libtards, but as we know, Jeffrey Epstein was a, well, I hate the word supremacist, but basically he thought of his group as being better than everyone else. I don't like to use the word supremacist, but I guess you could say he was a Jewish supremacist and he was calling everyone else the Goyim. He wasn't an egalitarian, but the people he was blackmailing were kind of forced to parrot egalitarian talking points. It really just kind of shows that it's not this well-meaning naivety, but malice behind this.
I mean, there's even a bit as well that when she storms off, there's some, and the point about, well, Western democracy's first, one of her simps actually says, yeah, that's the idea. And then Richard Widmark says, well, so, okay, so now we know exactly where you're coming from, which is to say you're basically just on the side of the Soviets. I mean, there's somebody in the chat there kind of going on about how this is essentially a Thatcherite Reagan film. And it totally is. We were discussing before, like, it wears it on its sleeve.
So,
one of the things I will say is that when you get into the neoliberal paradigm, if they are, I mean, what we're talking about here is game theory. So where you just expect the other person to kind of screw you over, and then you draw your own strategy based on the fact that you will be just stabbed in the back and mugged, and then you kind of calculate what you're going to do on that basis. And a lot of the sort of nuclear deterrent stuff was like that. And when you get into the neoliberal agenda writ large and you encompass mass immigration, you can see that all of the inconveniences about human nature, which they do understand in terms of geopolitics, are totally jettisoned. So when you get into mass immigration, the idea is, well, at root, everybody is just this individualistic consumer without a wider ethnic or religious identity. And this has turned out to be just catastrophically failed. And in that scenario, my outlook within the multicultural paradigm is game theory, essentially. I just expect the worst. And I haven't been proven wrong at any. So it's kind of weird that when it comes to sort of you scale it up to humanity itself, the neoliberals actually do agree with her to a large extent. But when it's geopolitics and political blocks, and she would argue because they need that to keep themselves on top of the hierarchy of Western capitalism and all of this. But essentially, it's kind of convenient that when it's geopolitics, they do understand this sort of game theory approach, but then when it's multiculturalism, they don't.
And it's interesting because you see this today. So I remember back, it was maybe in like 2012, 2013 or so, but I remember there was this libtard site which I used to read called cracked.com. And they had some article like criticizing Ronald Reagan and saying he was insane because he had some like plan for nuclear war. And I remember thinking at the time, and look, like I'll be honest today, I do not think that Ronald Reagan was a good leader of the United States. He was, you know, basically like he was the archetypal boomer con, even though he wasn't a boomer, he was a lot older than that. But what all the stuff we criticize today with someone like Nigel Farage, that's what Ronald Reagan was. But I think though that like even if I might have disagreed with him ideologically, same can go with someone like Margaret Thatcher, it would have been totally reckless for him not to have some kind of policy for the event of a nuclear war. That doesn't mean that he wants a nuclear war to happen, but it was a very real possibility, and they had to have some kind of policy for that possibility. And you know, I kind of actually see some of this from the right today. With a lot of the geopolitics stuff you get from certain kinds of influencers, kind of the more the big example would be the Russia-Ukraine war, but you can also look at this with certain things with certain other geopolitical things, maybe stuff with China or Iran or whatever it may be. You think of podcasts like the Duran or people like Douglas MacArthur. Like Douglas MacArthur, he's a former general, but I remember he saw something on he posted something on Twitter about a year or so ago saying like, well, here is this plan for NATO to respond to a Russian attack. Well, this means that they want to go to war. Well, it doesn't actually really mean that, because it would be I'm a lifelong critic of the Western establishment of the present day and of their ideology and of the policies they pursued over the past couple of decades. But it would be irresponsible of them not to have some kind of defense policy. But then it seems like this talking point, anytime that that's brought up, you're always just like you're a NATO shill or you're a neocon or something like that. Now, I'm certainly not a neocon. So, for example, I'm totally against like what America is like looking like they might be doing with Iran soon. But you still have to have some kind of defense policy. And there seems to be this kind of talking point that you see on the right a lot in the last couple of years, that so if Europe builds up a military, that means that they must be warmongers and want to go to war with Russia. But that's kind of ignoring the fact that Russia has launched a massive invasion of Ukraine and there's a giant war just right across the border. You kind of actually have to have a policy for if something happens. But then this same kind of dynamic that you would have seen from the lefty kind of anti-nuclear weapon crowd, you kind of see a lot of that from the populist, the populist right, and the kind of its overlap with people like Alexander Dugin or all these kind of podcasters like Duran. It's almost like because the end result of their policy wouldn't actually be peace; it would just be the BRICS country.
I mean, I heard Scott Ritter on Judge Knapp, and he went off on this like crazy tirade about how what was that plan called where they were going to basically destroy Germany after the war? Because Germany had started to implement policies, they had been shuttling weapons and whatnot to Ukraine, and Scott Ritter went on this unhinged tirade about how the Germans would have to be taught their lesson again. But it went beyond sort of checking them geopolitically, and it went into like blood, and it was as if like they'll never learn. The Morgenthau plan, where it was basically just going to eradicate Germany and Germans. And Ritter came out on this crazy rant on Judge Knapp, basically, he actually said that's what they should have done. We should have implemented the Morgenthau plan after World War II. And I thought, and he was just given this like free pass because they're all so like sympathetic to the Russian side of it that he just got a pass. And he was just Judge Knapp's just nodding along. Oh, crazy old Ritter going off. And I thought, I'm not on board with this. What the hell am I listening to? Yeah, these people are nuts. But yeah,
I mean, it's kind of the mirror image of what I mentioned earlier with, you know, these people purport to be the ones in favor of peace and the geopolitical realists and stuff. But really, is just this nihilistic destruction that they're in favor of, because that's the end result. It's not peace. He's like out there saying that he wants Germany to be wiped out and he wants their blood. It's like, what, weren't you like somebody talking about? Like claiming that you're some like peace activist or some geopolitical realist or something like that. And well, when you scratch the surface with types like this, you end up just getting some nihilist who wants to burn down the world.
Yeah.
For the benefit of the other side though.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, just to go back to the point, I do absolutely think this, I mean, I mentioned it before at the beginning, but I do think this is a kind of propaganda of that age, of Thatcher, of Reagan. I mean, we've discussed this before. Like, you get in the 70s, you get all this doom and gloom and all of this self-doubt. You could say that this is kind of like the British version of Rambo 2, though it's much more gritty and realist in its assessment. But it's still this, if you want to look at it like propaganda, which isn't too wide of the mark, to be honest. It is where you can look at it as a Brit and you can look at it, this is amazing. Look what we can do. I can take pride in my civilization. And you think that because that's the intention. But I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with that. Would anybody want to watch a woke, like 2020 version of this? I think they actually had one, but I never watched it. I never went anywhere near it. But all of these things are going to be stuck in their main part, their era. There's not much way around it. And what you're looking at, for better or for worse, I think for better, to be honest, is Britain, which is competent and proud of itself and won't take any shit from subversive sources. I wish we had that, a bit more of that today. I mean, eventually, of course, you're going to get into the, after that, the, to get back to the film, what happens after the scene in the ballroom, which we discussed for quite a long time, with this whole idea of the ideological confrontation that happens, which I quite enjoy. But then afterwards, Skellen flashes a mirror, which I'm amazed nobody saw that, like out the bathroom, and he's giving a signal outside. He's going to cause a distraction. And then it's like all systems go, they're going to bring in the SAS. And this is the bit, like, this is the most famous part. It's only the last 15 minutes of the film, or even that. And then the boys with the masks come in. And throughout the film as well, like, we have actually seen them training for everything that they're about to sort of be thrown at. And the other thing which we hardly touched on is the arc of Skellen's wife and child being held captive by the German one. And so you see that it's what you're getting is quite a wide spectrum here, because my impression was always just the men in those respirator masks in black. But we actually see that they are also, according to this movie, doing intelligence gathering, they're infiltrating, but they can also do lower key operations, like slowly and quietly drilling through a wall where people are being held hostage. And then when they do get through, they'll just shoot you five times in the face before you do anything about it. And the problem that I've got is that it's great when it's paternalistic and it's patriotic. It's just not so great when you think this machine is being turned on you or what you want to see, you know?
When they're at Skellen's house. So the two terrorists have Skellen's wife and daughter held hostage. So what the SAS do is they go into the neighbor's house, which is, it's like a duplex. So their houses are attached through a wall, and they are kind of like slowly drilling through the wall while also blasting the music and so that they can't hear. I just love that scene. and then I also, of course, love the scene in the embassy at the end when the SAS just burst in and shoot the place up and just take out the terrorists. I just love that precision where they're running down the hall, checking the corners. They see the guy and he blasts him in 1 second. It reminds me of some of these Rainbow Six games or what are the other ones? SOCOM or Splinter Cell, or, you know, a lot of the games that I grew up. I know this was a lot earlier than that, but I've always really kind of like that. I've always kind of liked that genre. There was actually something else I did want to get onto. It's a bit related to what we were talking about earlier, but it's another theme you see in the movie. It's the idea of doomsday theories, because we've talked about this before with Watchmen. So I think that this one's kind of the anti-Watchmen, because the People's Lobby, they're so convinced that there's going to be some nuclear war if there isn't nuclear disarmament.
That's a great spot, by the way. Yeah, that hadn't occurred to me, but yeah, you're right. Yeah, go on, explain this.
In the film, the People's Lobby, their entire cause is nuclear disarmament, and they're so convinced that if they don't take the most extreme of actions to force nuclear disarmament, then a catastrophe is imminent. And this is actually the same logic Ozymandias, the primary villain in Watchmen, was functioning under. So it takes place in the 1980s as well.
Nope, he seems to be breaking.
He's also
soaking.
Oh, can you hear me?
Hello? Yeah, you're fine. You just broke up for a second. Oh. You're all right now.
Okay, yeah. So In Watchmen, Ozymandias is convinced that there's going to be a nuclear war. It's the 1980s. It's the Cold War. Again, it was actually written as a critique of Reaganism and Thatcherism, whereas this one's kind of a defense of it. And the, what he does in Watchmen is that he creates a cataclysm and blames it on Dr. Manhattan. And the point of that is to prevent a nuclear war between the U.S. and the USSR. So he kills millions in order to save billions. And this is kind of what the, even though they're trying to say, we're not going to actually kill people, but we're just going to cause a nuclear explosion to demonstrate how bad it is. What you see is that it's functioning under this assumption that this nuclear cataclysm is inevitable. However, as we would see in our own timeline, it never ended up happening. So Ozymandias' plan in Watchmen and the plan of the People's Lobby in Who Dares Wins illegitimate because the threat that they claimed to be against that never actually ended up materializing. So what you see was with a lot of ideologues, they for their ideology and for their extremism, and they always function under the assumption that this is bound to happen unless they take the most extreme actions. It's the same thing that you see behind something like the climate change agenda. So like I mentioned earlier, they want this like totalitarian globe spanning grid to regulate carbon emissions or something like that, based on the assumption that if we don't do this, the entire world's going to be destroyed. You saw that during the pandemic as well, the idea that we have to have this totalitarian control grid, or else this virus is going to wipe us out, when, you know, it's kind of ended up being a joke. But ideologues always, like, they always kind of default to that. They always default to this idea that, like, my cataclysm is bound to happen if we don't take the most extreme actions. I think this is also something that the far right is guilty of at times as well. Now, I do think, you know, I mean, I do believe in things like that, things like demographic shifts are actually pushing us towards disaster. I think you probably all know my views on that, but I reject this idea of accelerationism. So something you might see on the right sometimes, on the far right, would be this idea that we need to, that the salute, there's going to be this mass civil war or societal collapse or people like fighting in the street, and that the answer is to go off and, like, you know, get buy hundreds of guns and tens of thousands of rounds of ammunition and go hide in a bunker in the woods in Montana or something like that. And what you find is that, I mean, from our perspective, it makes somebody totally politically useless. But it's the same kind of logic with what you get with a lot of ideologues, that they base it on some cataclysm and always have the assumption that that cataclysm is bound to happen, when in reality, many times it isn't.
Yeah, so... anyway, we go on. I'm just looking at the casual insult by Klangabasha in the chat there, calling me a simpleton. So thanks for that. So anyway, Lewis Collins moves on, and then sadly Frankie gets riddled with bullets, and then that's it. But he hesitates. And then Tony Doyle says, "You're getting a bit slow, aren't you, Skellen? Now move your arse." And there's loads of lines like that where it's just this sort of lads banter, like on me in five and all of that kind of thing. And unfortunately, that's the end of Frankie, and it's the end of the movie. But I do think it is military grade propaganda, but I still kind of love it. And you're right, though, that you can look back now and you can think what she was afraid of just never happened. And it didn't happen because everybody understood that everybody would get nuked together. And so to go back to the Ozymandias, the Watchmen thing, if you have a look at what would have happened, so let's just say, let's just say a far leftist wrote the script, and instead of getting riddled with bullets at the end, Frankie was successful, that the nukes were released. She didn't seem to care if the civilians got evacuated or not. But then the nukes get released, and then they drop a nuke on a patch of the Scottish countryside, which is then covered in a cloud. Let's say only 50 people die, But then we've got like 5,000 years of radiation bathing over Scotland, and the rest of the world is just going to be watching, thinking, like, the West is nuts. The West is totally suicidal. You know that meme where you get all of these like sort of figures representing the different countries of the West, and then it's got America like shooting itself with a shotgun, and that's what it would be like from the outside. It would be like, well, we've just decided to nuke ourselves for no reason whatsoever. It wouldn't have affected their stance on nukes at all. It would, because they've also got nukes point. I mean, all right, fair enough, this is the Cold War. But you also had the problem between Russia and China, even within the communist world. Like, they've got their own stuff going on. So it was just this is why these lefties are batshit crazy, absolutely nuts. And it's, you can say, well, it's all just neocon propaganda, it's like thought of Thatcher, liberal. Yeah, okay, but the fact is they do exist. They are like this. They do exist regardless of who's in charge, unless it was our guys and they'd all be in jail. One of the things that I wanted to get into a little bit again, though, was at the very end of the movie, you see somebody who I think he's called Roger, and he's an MP, and he has a little chat, and he's being briefed on what has gone down here. And then you see the sinister and strange character called Malak appears again for the third time. And they're like, it didn't really go down too well at that moment. And they're like, well, don't worry, we've got lots of plans for the future. And the implication here is that the back out, right? So it's not just an implication, it is that. Actually, Frankie and her crew of lefties were just useful idiots, and that people from outside, not actually the Soviet Union, but what it seems like is the Arab world. Bear in mind, again, you've got the Middle East connection because of the Iranian regime at this point, this time, have actually infiltrated the upper stratas of the British government and the British political class. And they're in with it. So they are turning a blind eye to it. And I feel as if... so what you get is the sense that what we've seen in this film was just a small, like a little sort of sketch of a much wider part. Do you know how when in the Daniel Craig James Bond, they connected it all up? So it was all... You went back through the previous four films, and then you could say, well, they were all belong to Spectre, or that it was all set up to do this. I think I have a feeling that they were going to kind of do some like a kind of Who Dares Win cinematic universe, where then in the next episode, Skellen would be like on the trail of some corrupt politician, or maybe he'd go behind the Iron Curtain or into the Middle East or something like that. Like, I get the feeling as if they had loads of adventures lined up for the SAS and Skellen in the future fighting this network, but it just never came to fruition. So, which is kind of sad when you think of it. It's sad. Lewis Collins died at 67 some years ago of cancer, which is also sad because he's probably the most underrated British Chad.
So the ending scene, you see that it's actually somebody within the British elite who was working with this Malik character to fund the People's Lobby. Now, I didn't actually fully understand, and I guess I now realize that the movie didn't actually disclose what his motive was. But what you see is that they had ulterior motives and that someone was pulling the strings. Now, I try not to be someone who's too conspiratorial, but the fact of the matter is that groups like Antifa, BLM, Extinction Rebellion, they portray themselves as being these radical rebels. I mean, they certainly are insane. That is real. The insanity of groups like that they actually do think that way. But there oftentimes is some. They aren't really these rebels against the status quo, when in reality, someone behind them is propping them up and funding a lot of money into them. So you think of things like BLM, like that had billions of dollars funneled into it. And they aren't really genuinely opposed to the system in any real way. Controlled opposition and kind of these puppet groups, something like what the People's Lobby would be in the movie Who Dares Wins. What it allows people to do, what allows the elite class to do, is to advance certain causes without getting their hands dirty. So this guy in the House of Lords and Malik, the guys who are kind of orchestrating it. Now, I do think that this group, it is in the movie that these people were actually insane. They actually did form organically. They were actually these mad leftist Marxists, but somebody in the elite class kind of saw a potential for something there, and they decided to funnel a bit of money in. Now, why they did that, it's not actually explained in the movie, but what that kind of allows elites to do is that they can allow these radical groups, these activist groups, to really kind of do their bidding without getting their hands dirty. So, you know, when let's think of something like the BLM riots. So when they like defaced a bunch of statues and tore down a bunch of historical monuments and everything like that. I mean, the agenda of the ruling class is this kind of is white replacement and the kind of turning everyone into this like soulless consumerist blob of a hodgepodge of the third world. They can't. I mean, if someone in the elite class is coming out and saying that they want to do that, that's not going to go over so well. But, you know, creating this phony like historical narrative and wrapping it in this hyper moralistic cause and then just getting the authorities to turn a blind eye as a bunch of far left crazies go out in the street and then tear down a historical monument that they say, well, this guy in the past was a racist or something like that. Well, it gets the job done without actually getting the hands dirty of the people in power. And I try not to be too conspiratorial because I do think that every group that succeeds is going to have some kind of funding. So even something from the opposite direction, something from the right, eventually it does need funding to actually get things done. And ultimately, I don't want to give the idea that everything which happens in the world was already pre-planned. I think what happens is that various elements of the elite fund the various agendas which they support, and you know, whichever one wins out is what ends up happening. But it's something you see in our world all the time today. It might have seemed very conspiratorial to someone in the 1980s, but these days, I mean, all the funding going towards groups like BLM, all that's out in the open.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing new. That governments have been creating false opposition for 100 years. I mean, the Bolsheviks were doing it. Lenin was doing it. And it's tricky when you are into like a sort of dissident politics to know which way is up or down. There's something to be said that just the knowledge of the fact that they're doing that is kind of enough to make you not so much that it's going to sort of turn you into a kind of psycho, but that you may just think, what's the point? You know, I'm very familiar with people who are kind of like, what's the point? It'll all just end. And especially, you know, I mean, it's a bit topical, but especially we've got like Rupert Lowe, the Restore stuff going on. And it is that there's a lot of people that are kind of like, I just don't trust it. We've been burned so many times. Is this the real deal? I would say it is, because we know that Farage represents the fake. But then again, you know, is there like layers and layers to it? I honestly don't think so in this case. That's not to say that there's not going to be dirty tricks and shenanigans. There probably absolutely certainly will be. But yeah, there you go. Who dares wins. There you say, tricky woo, why even fall for it again? Well, that's a widespread sentiment, but what do you do? Like, just nothing? That's any final parting shots on Who Dares Wins?
No, it was a good, fun movie. Great action. I like that it kind of took some shots at the left. I know it might be through a Reaganite, Thatcherite framing, and of course, I'm a critic of that ideology. But you know, it still was pretty fun. It's still fun to see shots taken at the left now and then. I mean, God knows we don't see that very often in Hollywood. And the action was great. I liked the kind of gritty realism of the movie. It was kind of like I mentioned earlier, a bit more of like a James Bond movie, but a bit more grounded in the real world. So I had fun with this one.
It is nice that the SAS genuinely are this iconic British thing, which, I don't want to kind of die. That is a, it's it, but it looks strangely dated now. Are we going to get images of the SAS doing anything like that now? What we get now, if there's like a terrorist attack or something, you get like armed police who kind of look a bit like that. But for whatever reason, you don't have that mystique, that aura. And look, let's be honest, like a lot of it was created by this film. But if you look at the pictures, the photos, the footage of the Iranian embassy thing, it looked almost identical to this. Like there's really nothing in it. And it's kind of like, yeah, I can't help. I can't, for all me cynicism. And all of the burnout and everything, I can't help but still sort of get a few jitters when I see the respirator masks and the black thing. Even though these days they'd be more likely to come through my window, but
Yeah.
this is the but whatever. That's it is what it is. This is the tragedy. This is the tragedy of it all. I don't want to hate the British government or deep state. I've just got no choice.
Right. And that, where I first heard of the SAS was from the video game Call of Duty 4. I played that when I was a teenager, and yeah, they had those iconic gas masks, and they're bursting through windows, and there was Captain Price and Soap McTavish and all and Gaz and all these cool badass guys going on these missions against some like terrorist cell from the east. And no, I mean, the movie, I mean, this is a precursor to it. That this probably served as the original inspiration, but it kind of brought me back. It kind of brought me back to those days, because it was, I mean, this was the 2000s, and
I
regardless of
mean,
what was going on politically, I mean, you were still allowed to have one of these. You were still allowed to have masculine white men in video games, going off and busting through windows and taking out terrorists. And it's a lot of fun.
just look at that image of Lewis Collins looks maxing and aura farming there. I mean, just as they'd say it again, it's disgusting, like Zuma language. Like that's Lewis Collins looks maxing. But as people are saying, he was actually a real soldier. He was in the parachute regiment. He was a tough guy. There wasn't any. This isn't just some gym bro. I mean, there's a whole thing. To be honest, I know we're winding down, but one of the things, I was out walking my dog. Give us a couple of minutes. I was out walking my dog the other day, thinking about it just after I watched it, and I noticed that there is like this kind of hardness to soldiers, and which you don't tend to see in like modern gym bros, where they're all beefed up with muscles and they've got like sort of plastic looking skin and everything. And we were talking about it before, but when I was growing up, there was tons and tons of people went into the army because they were being recruited from the north and from Scotland and stuff like that. And when they came out, they all had, I mean, look, the expression on his face, they all had that. They genuinely did. They all seem to have this kind of arrogance, or you could say confidence, or this self-assuredness. But it was kind of grating and it got on my nerves quite a bit at the time. But that's because of it had been drilled into them. And it's strange because they were hard as nails as well. I mean, the recruitment in the Northeast was, I don't know what it was like in other parts of the country, but when you were like 15 or 14, you would actually go on trips to army barracks, and you'd go across, I did, and you'd go across the assault course, and they would really put the bait on you. It was just the boys as well, and they would really put the bait on you to join up. And I remember when I went along and there was a fella standing there and he looked exactly like Lewis Collins, who he just had the jumper on. And he was talking about how him and two of his mates went into a pub down south and cleared it out. So there's like three of them and they just cleared this whole bar out. And he was saying like the average man on the street, I'll just wipe me arse with them because of the training that I've had. That training can be yours if you want it. or you can be gay for all your life. That was the shit we were getting. Like, they were, that was what they were like. And it's kind of, I didn't used to like it at all, but it's such a contrast with that. And let's be honest as well, a lot of them had actually been off. A lot of them had been served in Northern Ireland or the Gulf or wherever. There was a thing as well where they would give you they'd give you the adverts, and then it would be like pictures of people jet skiing off Malta and this kind of thing. And then when you actually signed up, you'd get sent to Belfast. Like everybody knew that was the thing. But it that kind of hard masculinity, which is kind of, you know, that's actually when you get people who are genuinely tough like that, they tend to be bastards. It's a tough world. And it's a world away from like today's looks maxing gym bunnies. It's a totally different kind of toughness and hardness that I don't know if it's maybe the lads out who are in the army today, maybe it's still like that. I don't know. But they all looked at you just as he's looking at us with this kind of contempt because you are a civvy normie. And they could wipe their arse on you and all of this kind of thing. It was a lot of them would come back and they were just widely despised. They were seen as being arrogant wankers and nobody wanted to go for a drink with them. But you couldn't, I mean, they were tough, like, but you know.
I mean, when I was in my early 20s, I actually was considering joining the military reserves. But the reason I didn't do it is that it was all just this LGBT. Anti-white feminism crap, and I just wanted nothing to do with it. Like, it was just chock full of all this woke managerial dog crap that we see that all the institutions are infested with today, and I just wanted nothing to do with it. And but the shame is that I actually like the martial virtues, and I kind of wanted to be part of it, but just looking at the institution itself, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm not doing that. So unfortunately, I had to settle for being the gym bro, the one that you think is kind of a pussy and not actually the hard man like the soldier. But I guess it'll just have to do for me, just being the gym bro.
Wow, yeah, I'm just sort of waxing lyrical about youthful trauma and the times I was masculinity, what was it, mogged. All right, I'm never going to speak like that again. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Have you got any idea what we're doing next month?
Yeah, I think we might do one a bit different. I'm thinking of doing The Founder, the one about McDonald's with Michael
All right. Keaton. Oh, great. I like that. That's a great film. All right. See you later, folks.